I introduce to you United States Senator John Walsh.
Montana has a new U.S. Senator. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck.
And that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. From Lieutenant Governor to United States Senator. Just one day after Montana Senator Max Baucus was confirmed as the next U.S. Ambassador to China, Governor Steve Bullock has appointed Lieutenant Governor John Walsh to serve out the remainder of Baucus' term. Walsh is already running to fill the post this coming November, and the move may bolster the Democratic Party's hopes to keep that seat in their control. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce covered today's announcement, and he spoke this afternoon with News Director Sally Mock.
Dan, with Senator Baucus confirmed as the new ambassador to China, the job of appointing his successor fell to Governor Steve Bullock, and surprise, surprise, he picked Lieutenant Governor John Walsh.
Actually, not that much of a surprise. It really isn't. It's been widely expected Walsh would be the choice ever since President Obama nominated Senator Baucus in December. Governor Bullock wouldn't speak about the potential appointment, saying he didn't want to comment on this hypothetical scenario of Baucus leaving the Senate. But Bullock had already endorsed Walsh for the seat, and in announcing the appointment today from the governor's reception room in the Capitol building, he said he did not interview anyone for the post, choosing whom he thought would be most effective.
I wanted to appoint someone who I believed would represent the values Montanans hold important. I wanted to appoint someone who I believe that would be working to find solutions, not further dividing our state and our nation.
So, Dan, Senator Walsh will have about a year in office, and how is he going to be spending his time?
Well, before being elected as lieutenant governor in 2012, Walsh spent more than 30 years in the Montana National Guard, the last 4 years of which he was adjutant general. That's the head of the Guard. He says he wants to continue focusing on veterans' issues. He also wants to work on creating jobs, improving the economy, reducing the national debt, and protecting civil liberties. He says when he talks to Montanans, he hears there's a lot that needs to be fixed in Washington.
There are too many politicians who put their own political agendas ahead of what's right. Too many folks who don't take their responsibility seriously. That's not how I work, and that's not how Montanans work.
Up until now, Dan Walsh has had two primary challengers in his Democratic race for the Senate, political unknown Wilsall rancher Dirk Adams and former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger. But that could change.
Yeah, I spoke with Mr. Bollinger this afternoon. He says he's most likely out.
I would be running against an incumbent who has an incredible ability to raise money. And unfortunately, money plays such a significant role in who gets elected. I just feel that the wise thing to do would be to withdraw.
Sally, Governor Bullock's appointment of Walsh has also resulted in a quick backlash from the Montana Republican Party.
And Republicans are characterizing it as a backroom political deal.
Right. Speaking with Montana Republican Party Executive Director Bowen Greedwin today, he says that's what it looks like to him.
It's a partisan ally who's running for the Senate, who has said publicly that he thinks this will help his name recognition. And boom, it's a done deal without any kind of public awareness of how that decision was reached.
Sally, already this afternoon on YouTube, the state GOP posted this video with that menacing kind of music we associate with negative campaign ads, and it says, John Walsh, an insider appointed by insiders.
And of course, an insider image is exactly what Walsh has been looking to avoid. He wanted to run as someone without a prior political record.
Yeah, he will have one now, though. And we'll see if being an incumbent helps or hurts him in his race against the likely Republican nominee, Montana Congressman Steve Daines.
And speaking of Congressman Daines, he was rather diplomatic in his response to the appointment today.
Yeah, I'll read his statement here. Quote, I look forward to working with John. It's an honor to go to work each day on behalf of the people of Montana who have entrusted me to serve them. And soon Montanans will have the opportunity to decide who best represents Montana's priorities in the U.S. Senate. End quote. But Sally, he's not waiting in the wings. Congressman Daines is trying to attract his own attention today. He has an ad which will begin airing during the Olympics tonight, speaking coincidentally about veterans.
Their bravery and sacrifice make our country great. That's why I voted to protect military pay and veterans' pensions. And as your senator, my commitment to them will never waver.
And Dan, what's the next step here with soon-to-be Senator John Walsh?
His resignation as lieutenant governor is effective Sunday night. He'll be sworn in as senator on Tuesday in Washington. Governor Bullock, meanwhile, says he has not chosen a new lieutenant governor yet, but that announcement will be coming soon.
Well, I've been speaking with Capitol reporter Dan Boyce about today's appointment of Lieutenant Governor John Walsh as Montana's next United States Senator. Dan, thanks.
Thank you.
And in other news from around the state, Northwestern Energy says it came close to breaking a record of its own during this week of record-breaking cold. Spokesman Butch Larcom says customers are using lots of natural gas.
We measure, you know, our statewide natural gas consumption in MCF, million cubic feet, and we used about 290 million cubic feet yesterday, which is a real high level for us. The record is 302 MCF, and that was set in early December during that cold snap we had.
Larcom says Northwestern probably would have broken a record if it hadn't have taken steps to curb consumption.
We asked some of our customers, our larger customers that have agreed to interruptible contracts, to curtail their use of gas. And if we hadn't have done that, we certainly would have gone over the 302 mark. When we agree to deliver gas to a big customer, that they, if they agree to have their supply interrupted, they can get it at a lower rate. And then we're able to use that gas to serve residential customers and, you know, make sure everybody has heat, you know, in a real cold snap.
Thousands of homes in the Bitterroot Valley lost power yesterday morning because of a problem with a Northwestern Energy transmission line. Temperatures dipped to about 24 below at that time. Larcom says that was an unfortunate exception to an otherwise well-performing infrastructure.
Generally, we've been doing very well. You know, the cold can put a lot of stress on our distribution system, but we haven't had very many outages. We did have the one down in the Bitterroot, and we are attributing it to the cold, where a line essentially just appeared to sort of snap, and it caused a problem pretty much all across the east side of the valley down there for yesterday morning. But, you know, we were able to get people back in service pretty quickly, which was fortunate. But other than that, the outages have been pretty isolated.
Temperatures will start to moderate this weekend, easing customer demand for natural gas and electricity.
Kids with chaotic family situations, with behavior and mental issues, as young as you can imagine, end up needing emergency housing. The need for foster families trained to help these kids is ever present. Katrin Fry reports the need in the Flathead is great, as kids are frequently shipped out of the area because there's nowhere for them to go locally.
Youth Dynamics is a nonprofit organization operating across Montana. Katie Gerton works out of the Kalispell office, licensing people to be foster parents. She says in the past 6 months, she's had about 20 children referred to her office to be placed in foster care that she's had to turn down. She says it's hard to find people up for becoming foster parents.
The biggest thing that I hear, you know, is that, you know, people are afraid of having a child in their home. You know, they don't know how that's going to work out with their family, or the biggest one is, I'm not ready yet.
Youth Dynamics specializes in therapeutic foster care. Therapeutic foster care, or TFC, also involves therapy, support aids for caregivers, medication management, and respite services for parents and caregivers. Children will generally get involved with Youth Dynamics through referral, sometimes from a state agency like Child Protective Services. They will also get involved as a sort of stepping stone coming out of a shelter or group home. Gerton says often a child needs the special care, but it isn't available for them. She says this isn't unique to Youth Dynamics. All the child welfare agencies spend time scrambling to find placements for kids.
And I used to work as a caseworker, a case manager here, as well as licensing coordinator, and it broke my heart to have to refer kids to shelters or just have to turn down placement for kids coming out of group homes, and they really had nowhere to go.
Gerton says sometimes there's an issue with kids or teens who are in trouble for sexual assault. She says oftentimes these cases stem from abuse that child received. Sometimes the child has mental health issues and needs to learn basic coping skills.
We let parents look at their records before they take on the child because we want the placement to work. We want them to know what they're getting into. But if you look at a child's, just like their progress notes, their treatment plan, you're looking at all the problems of that child. We don't document positive things in an incident report. We just don't. And it can be scary.
Foster parent Carla Hunt has been involved with Youth Dynamics since last spring. Hunt also has a son, just about to enter his teenaged years. She says there's always a nervousness before a child comes into her home.
I get a little nervous because I don't know how they're going to react and how they're going to get along with everybody in the house. But usually it always ends up okay. But, you know, getting to know new kids and trying to figure out what they like to do and they don't like to do and if they're going to get along with my son. And
Hunt says it's a little different approach with setting rules for foster kids than for her own.
You have to treat them, I don't know, softer than what you would your own kid, you know, because they've been through a lot where your kid has more structure and has had a better environment to live in, and these kids haven't. So you kind of have to, you know, you have to kind of be lenient, but you have to be firm.
Hunt says she got involved because she saw an ad in the paper asking for people to help with respite care. She did the training and then did more training to become a foster parent.
There's horror stories to everything. And there's, you know, and there's happy endings, too. You have to, you know, jump in and try and see if you can help one of these kids. That's why me and my husband got involved, is so we could help children that don't have stable environments.
Gerton says there are 17 hours of training involved with respite care and 30 hours for foster care. There's also a criminal history check through fingerprinting, a child and family services check, Department of Motor Vehicles check, employment, and they also look at other life issues like having had or lost a child recently. However, she says if something happened in your past, that doesn't necessarily exclude you. She says they're not looking for perfect people. Rather, people who can provide a safe home.
A lot of these kids come from pretty unstable, horrific environments. Your home is going to be wonderful to them. I guarantee it.
Gerton says some of the other foster care options in the Flathead include through the local branch of Intermountain Children's Home and the state. She says if there's no placement for a child, they'll go to a shelter or group home. And lots of the time, that's at Watson's Children's Shelter in Missoula, Chaudière Children's Hospital in Helena, or Acadia in Butte. Gerton says right now she has 8 foster parents on her list, and she's in the process of licensing 3 more. She says she'd feel comfortable if she had 40 homes on her list in the Flathead. Statewide, the statistic is that about 3,000 kids will enter the foster care system each year. That's new children going into the system, just in Montana. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Federal agencies will be spending $865,000 to help restore Helena's primary watershed. The 10-mile watershed lies just southwest of the capital city and provides 80% of the community's drinking water. The restoration is one of 13 projects across the country announced this week by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in conjunction with the U.S. Forest Service. USDA Undersecretary for Natural Resources and the Environment Robert Bonney unveiled the $30 million partnership in Helena. He sat down with Capital reporter Dan Boyce to speak about the project, which is part of the national strategy to help address the impacts of climate change.
Undersecretary Bonney, this project is being called the Chiefs Joint Landscape Partnership. $30 million, 13 projects, 12 states this year. It's a partnership between the Forest Service and the USDA's Natural Resource Conservation Service. But really, you're working on public-private partnerships here. You say this project we'll be working across traditional boundaries and restoring the health of our forests and watersheds, whether they're on public or private lands. That was in a press release. What do you mean by that?
So one of our top priorities at USDA is to restore the health of a nation's forests. And obviously in the West here, you have a tremendous amount of acreage on public lands, but we also have important areas on private lands. So what we're doing here is we're combining two agencies, one that focuses on the public lands piece largely, which is the U.S. Forest Service, and an agency, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is focused on working with private working lands. Now, we know that in order to combat fires, we need to work at a landscape level to do treatments that reduce hazardous fuels, that thin forests so that we can reduce catastrophic fires and protect watersheds. And so we're both going to be working on the federal lands, that is on the Forest Service, National Forest lands, and on the private working lands. And our expectation is with these 13 projects, we're going to have about $30 million set aside for this work. And that's money from the Forest Service budget, but it's also money from the Farm Bill. And so we'll use those dollars, those Farm Bill dollars, to work off the federal lands. The other important piece about this is the partnership. So in the city of Helena, the partnership with the city, the partnership with the governor, and those are going to be critical to getting this work done.
Right. Let's go ahead and talk about the project here in Montana. It's $865,000 for the Red Mountain Flume and Chessman Reservoir that's just outside of Helena here. Why is it that this project makes the cut, and what exactly is going to be happening there?
So we looked for projects where we had partners in place so that we could kick this effort off, and the city of Helena, the state of Montana, and others have been working in this area for a long time with the U.S. Forest Service. There's also a recognized need here. We've got significant bark beetle dead trees in the watershed. It's a critical watershed for the city of Helena, so there's a real need to do work here and to work both on the public lands and the private lands. We're committing about $865,000 this year, but we're going to continue this work over time, and our expectation is that we will continue to have this level, if not more, funding on this project. Indeed, we think some of the Farm Bill dollars will be enhanced in the out years.
Mm-hmm. So on the ground, folks will be coming in, folks from the National Forest Service, folks from the USDA, coming in there and actually doing tree removal projects, mitigation. How does it actually work out on the ground?
So on the Forest Service side, we're moving forward with a project in the watershed and expect to be out with a decision soon that will allow that work to move forward on the national forest land. But on the private working lands, we're going to come in, write conservation plans. Our Natural Resources Conservation Service will come in and write conservation plans for landowners. These plans will detail thinning, hazardous brush removal, removal of beetle-killed timber, but also things that they can do to reduce sedimentation, to protect the watershed in other ways. And then over time, we will cost-share those activities that the landowners carry out. So we'll pay us for a substantial portion of those activities that, as they get carried out in the watershed.
So the whole wider nationwide project that's being built as part of the Obama administration's climate action plan, how is it that these individual projects, this $30 million, becomes a part of that umbrella goal?
That's a good question. One of the things that the president recognized in the climate action plan that the administration put out last summer was the importance of making sure our lands are more resilient in the face of climate change. And one of the challenges we have is wildland fire. Our fire seasons are 60 to 80 days longer than they used to be a few decades ago. We're burning about twice as much acres than we used to about two or three decades ago. So we have some substantial challenges and in part caused by climate change. And so these dollars will ensure that these forests are more resilient, that we protect our watersheds. And so, you know, our effort, this is part of a broader effort to increase the pace and scale of restoration, both on our public lands, but also on our private lands.
So $30 million is a lot of money, Mr. Undersecretary, but many climate scientists would argue that $30 million would be a drop in the bucket when it comes to what's actually needed to address climate change. Is this money really going to make any sort of meaningful difference when we talk about our wider needs to address this problem nationwide?
Yeah, I think both when you look at climate change and when you look at the challenge facing our forests, yes, there are significant challenges. But I think that means we have to be focused in where we spend money. So here, the project in Montana, we're focusing on an area that's critical to the city of Helena, both for their water, but also for the safety of the homes and of the city there because of the fire hazard. And so we're going to focus those dollars in the way where they have the most public benefit and the most benefits to the ecological health of our forests. On the one hand, yes, it's just $30 million. But on the other hand, that's a lot of money that we can use over time. Again, our expectation is this is going to be a multiple-year effort. There are going to be multiple projects. We're already starting to have interest in other areas of the country where we can have additional projects. And I would just say from a budgetary standpoint, this is part of a much broader effort that we're taking at USDA around landscape resilience in the face of climate change.
How much does the president feel can actually be accomplished? What is possible to be accomplished in terms of addressing climate change during the current administration while it's still in office?
Well, I would say this is a very high priority for the president. It's a very high priority for a number of cabinet secretaries. The president last summer put out the Climate Action Plan, which has dozens of activities that we're being charged with following up on. USDA has done two activities this week, which are part of that plan. One is we announced the creation of climate hubs to help farmers and ranchers and forest landowners better utilize good information so they can adapt to climate change over time. A second one was the project today around forest restoration, and that's critically important for forest resilience. So I think those are just two small activities, but EPA is moving forward with regulatory actions that are going to reduce carbon pollution, and there are a number of other activities at the Department of Energy, that we at USDA, the Department of Interior, Department of Commerce, Department of Transportation, even the Department of Defense is involved in this effort. So, you know, it's difficult to get things done in Congress right now, but there's a lot we can do through executive actions and I think make a real difference on the climate.
So we're speaking here shortly after you just spoke upstairs in the Capitol building here about the Land and Water Conservation Fund. So that fund was created by Congress in 1965, and it essentially takes royalties from offshore oil and gas drilling, and it puts that money toward safeguarding our natural resources, safeguarding public lands. The state of Montana has received a lot of attention from this fund over the years, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Montana's benefited in an enormous way, both by the lands that have been protected for their recreational value, for their open space value, for their access to public lands. It's been critical, but it's also for those reasons, but it's also been critical because of the jobs it's created. I mean, think about the outfitters, the fly shops, we heard from a manufacturer of waders during our celebration upstairs. So there's an enormous economic impact of the Land and Water Conservation Fund and the ability of that fund to create jobs out on the landscape. And so we heard about some of that today. We also heard about some of the partnerships that are critical, and Montana's been a real leader in that. This Montana Legacy Project in the Crown of the Continent has protected an enormous landscape. It's done it voluntarily. It's done it collaboratively. It's done it ranchers working with environmentalists, working with forest industry, working with the federal government. And in that way, Montanans have really led on this. And so I think it's appropriate that we came here with the governor and expressed both our thanks, but also point to the need for continued funding for LWCF.
So the fund is in your portfolio as undersecretary. It's set to expire this year. If that were to be the case, what would ultimately be the consequence to Montana?
Well, you know, the Land and Water Conservation Fund right now is setting aside about $350 to $400 million a year in both our budget at the Department of Agriculture and the Forest Service, but more of it's actually in the Department of Interior budget. And those are that's helping protect wildlands. It's helping protect lands that are public parks and recreation facilities. And there's a huge economic importance of that as well as obviously an environmental importance. It's vital that we get this act reauthorized for the next 50 years, if it were. And it's vital that we fully fund this. And I think we're going to be doing more to talk about this, to talk about the importance of this program. It's got enormous public benefits, and we want to make sure that it's reauthorized.
Where is it sitting there at the federal level right now?
Well, this is something Congress has to do, and I think there's certainly broad support for it. We heard from the congressional staff that was there today for the Montana delegation. There's strong support here, and we heard obviously very strong support from Governor Bullock as well. So we think we've got support out there, but you know it's tough to get much done in Washington these days, and that's why we're really going to need folks that care about this to step up, to reach out to their members of Congress and to make sure that this is a priority.
Well, I've been speaking with Robert Bonney, a USDA Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment. He's in Helena to launch the Chiefs Joint Landscape Partnership. Mr. Bonney, thank you for your time. Stay warm out there.
Thank you. I will.
Now for this weekend's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter weather advisory for snow in effect from 5 a.m. to 11 p.m. tomorrow for the Missoula and Bitterroot Valleys, as well as the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with areas of snow. Lows should be 0 to 7 degrees above. Tomorrow, snow is likely with highs 19 to 26 degrees. Sunday calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow, and highs should be in the mid-20s to lower 30s. In central Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow and lows 5 below to 10 below 0. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow through the day and highs 5 to 10 degrees. On Sunday, it calls for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow and highs 5 to 15 degrees. In southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 5 to 10 degrees. Tomorrow, expect snow with highs in the 20s. And on Sunday, it calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs 25 to 30 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Dr. Tom Roberts.
For the past 4 years, Republicans in Congress have said that they intend to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as the ACA or Obamacare. They voted for this repeal over 40 times in the House, but until last week, we have not seen anything about what kind of replacement plan they would put in place. Finally, from three Republican senators, we have the outlines of new legislation to do just that, replace Obamacare. Although there would still be some fine-tuning, we can now see the major components of what we can expect if Republicans do gain a majority in the Senate and eventually put a Republican in the executive office. And what we see is not pretty. First, the similarities. The Republican plan would keep in place the $7 billion in Medicaid savings that Mitt Romney blasted during his 2012 presidential campaign, and the ban on lifetime spending limits for people with expensive chronic disease. That would stay, as well as the ability for children up to the age of 26 to remain on their parents' health insurance program. But in other crucial ways, the Republican plan is quite different. People with pre-existing disease would lose much of their protection under the ACA. People now with these illnesses cannot be refused coverage or charged higher rates. Not so under the Patient Choice, Affordability, Responsibility, and Empowerment, or so-called Patient Care Act. Similarly, women would be charged more than men of the same age, which is not allowed under the ACA. Older people could be charged up to 5 times what a younger person would pay for the same insurance, as opposed to only 3 times as much under the ACA. Subsidies under this Republican plan would be significantly less than under the ACA. Poor people who can now get significant help with purchasing insurance would be unable to afford good coverage. The exchanges would be eliminated, so there would be no way to easily compare plans for cost or coverage. Bare bones plans with high deductibles would be allowed, and insurance companies could sell plans that didn't cover mental health, maternity, or other basic benefits, which must be supplied under current law. Annual spending limits would also come back into play. These put a limit on spending by the insurance companies for any one individual in a yearly period. In addition, preventive services, which are now covered at 100%, would be subject to the same cost payments as anything else. Instead of supporting prevention, this approach would result in significantly less people getting these services. The mandate, of course, would also be eliminated under the Republican plan, so people could choose whether or not to spend money on health insurance. The old insurance company approach of trying to insure only the healthy people and avoid exposure to those with real health issues would again become the norm. This is quite different than the expectation embodied in the Affordable Care Act that we should all contribute to and support those with illness who have significant health care expenses. Medicaid expansion would be repealed, which is not yet an issue in Montana, but in addition, under this plan, the existing national Medicaid program would be scaled back. Poor people would have even fewer options than they do now. The most interesting component of the Republican plan, I think, is that it would eliminate part of the tax deduction that all of us in group plans now enjoy. If you obtain health insurance through your employer, the cost of that insurance is now considered a business expense and is not taxed. Under the Republican plan, this would no longer be the case. 35% of the money that an employer spent on a family's health insurance would be considered taxable income. This would mean an extra tax of close to $1,500 a year for an average family of four. And this is from the party that is opposed to raising taxes. Now, it's highly unlikely that we'll see this regressive plan put into effect during the next 3 years while President Obama is still in the White House. But we can see the profound differences in how Republicans think health insurance should be provided, or in many cases, not provided. Affordable, comprehensive, prevention-oriented health insurance available to everyone is not their priority. In comparison to the Affordable Care Act, this replacement plan should be unacceptable to most Americans. Whether this will be understood by the people who vote remains to be seen.
Dr. Tom Roberts is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening and have a great, safe, warm weekend.